the people here at Perimeter for hosting me. I've occasionally coming back here, and I'm always had a very fun time here. And so today I'm going to talk about electroweak quintessence action, which is a different topic from other things I have been working on. And I was just worried that maybe this talk might be for the wrong audience. And but this is supposed to be partly joint with cosmology, so it's organized that way. So some people might find it too elementary, some people might find incomprehensible, so it might depend on the background, but let me try what I'm going to say. So, okay, so what are we going to talk about? Well, what I'm going to talk about is about the swamp rand, and I heard that there's a talk by Korokiam, I think by Kamran, about the swamp rand. So people might heard about it, but let me try to give you a sort of an idea of what swamp rand is, and why it can be interesting as a very elementary introduction. And so what we are going to do as a physicist is that you're going to be some interesting results, like observations, etc. And we're trying to explain it. And if you are, for example, a quantum field theorist, then that means to come up with some effective quantum field theory to describe it. But of course, and sometimes it works very well, but in other cases, there is a huge possibility. So there are possible huge possibility of effective field theories, and it's not clear which theory to think about. And this is a very important problem, for example, in thinking about the beyond the standard model physics and LHC, and there is issue of naturalness, etc. So people have certainly thought about large possibilities of what can be described, the dark matter and everything. So there are a lot of possibilities. And the swamp rand idea is that perhaps you can cut down some possibilities by consulting the quantum gravity. So what is exactly does it meant by consulting quantum gravity? Well, so what it means is that at least, first of all, if you start with the quantum gravity, such as string theory, whatever that is, it will generate, as an end result, some low-energy effective quantum field theory. So that's certainly people have been doing for a long time. And in practice, that means to specify some setup. For example, you can take a heterotic compactation, Calabi-Yau 3, and then there are various choices of Calabi-Yau 3, and then it gives rise to a certain number of matter content, etc. And that's certainly not a unique possibility. There are other possibilities related by dualities. So what people typically meant in the string phenomenology for a long time is that let's take this theory and try to work out the consequences in this setup. So that's important work in the exploration of string theory and quantum gravity, but it's also a case that whatever results you derive in some particular compactation, that might not be completely general. So you find that there are certain results that hold true, but it can be that they might not hold if you consider other compactation of string theory, for example. And the swamp rand paradigm these days is to try to approach the problem from really a different angle, different direction. And instead of talking about specific constructions, the idea is that, okay, so this is a given effective field theory, and let's impose the condition that it has some UV completion. Some UV completion, so exists UV completion, and you don't necessarily know how, but let's impose the condition that exists. And then that cuts down the possibility already. And so the non-trivial point is that the concept of swamp rand, so there is a huge region of the possibility of a low energy effect field series, which looks completely consistent from low energy viewpoint, but somehow doesn't arise from quantum gravity. And that's a theory called the swamp rand, and that's as opposed to the landscape coming from quantum gravity and string theory. So the usual construction begins to explore the possibilities inside quantum gravity. Here we are discussing the impossibilities in quantum gravity theories. And of course the big question is, what's the boundary here and how to characterize that? And let's see. So that's a big question, and nobody has had the final word on that. But it seems to be that the constraint, well, first of all, there seems to be some theories which are actually in the swamp rand, they're not in the landscape. And some people even go farther, and then you have a sense that maybe string's landscape might be very special inside this parameter space effective field theory. Okay, so I don't mean to mean anything precise here, but sometimes, and also if it's a huge parameter space, but it might be that string theory, low energy effective field theory coming from string theory might be actually very, very special. And if this is the case, that has important consequences. about thinking about fine-tuning problems in phenomenology and cosmology. For example, after well, some recent results of LHC, people are talking about the fine-tuning problem. And but how, for example, you might be stuck here, and it looks extremely fine-tuned in the, inside all the possible effective field theory, but it might not be that fine-tuned inside the string theory landscape. So that's the idea of the swamp run, et cetera. So as a general idea, it seems extremely natural and interesting. Well, we, except that, of course, the whole point is that you don't necessarily know what quantum gravity is and what are the general consequences, et cetera. So that's the very tricky part of this business. So people, what people try to do is to formulate some conjectures. That's the swamp run conjectures. So these are supposed to be necessary but not sufficient conditions for the existence of UV compression. So that's something very concrete, typically you can verify whether it's just satisfied or not. And once you have that condition, it doesn't guarantee that it comes from some particular string theory, but at least you, it's a minimal check. And if that condition is not satisfied, you conclude that it doesn't belong to the string theory landscape. Well, but of course these are conjectures, and in fact, there is now that I think there are many swamp run conjectures in the market, but every one of them is a conjecture. So depending on preference, you might not believe any of these, but some people believe in some of these and are not interested in more speculative ones. So that's all up to you. But at least people try to make some educated guesses on what the general property of the quantum gravity is, and then try to formulate some conjectures. But still you need some input. So the input comes from several different ingredients. Well, let's see, for example, the semi-classical GR. By this, I mean black holes of entropy, Hawking radiates, and et cetera. Also, string theory gives rise to many examples. And so whatever conjecture you have, you can try to hope to check that in various examples. And sometimes there are quantitative and mathematical statements coming out. If you believe in a conjecture, then you can try to check that. But it's also the case that sometimes there are important input from observational phenomenological constraints. And that is the aspect somehow I became interested in recently. My talk is along these lines in a sense. Yes?
Specifically, by experiments, what kind of experiments you want?
Well, let's see. Basically, any experiment. But for example, the one I'm coming to right now in the next slide is, for example, there is a Higgs field in the standard model, for example. Those are some type of elementary things. But it can be also be, for example, it might be believed that the inflation happens, for example, and then what kind of constraint it can be, depending on the specific inflation model, for example. And well, there are also other constraints. If there is some scalar field in the people, for example, people say that the string theory often predicts a moduli, for example. And then there could be a moduli problem. There are fifth force such constraints and all these constraints. So, okay, so I'm not necessarily, so as long as there is something we can learn from that experiment, I'm happy to take that. Okay, so let's see. So, and then what my talk today is about trying to understand dark energy and somewhat along these lines. With a little bit of help. Actually, not too much, but a little bit of help with swamp run conjectures. But perhaps before coming to that, let me just say a few words about the swamp run conjecture, because this is the topic a lot of people ask me about. And probably Kamran also talked about this, and then, okay, so what is the conjecture? Well, it says that if you start with the low energy field theory, this is the potential. And the potential should satisfy this inequality, where the left-hand side is the derivative, and the right-hand side is the potential itself, which times all the one constant. And the left-hand side is, well, it's the size of the derivative, it's always positive. And also there is a huge number, Planck constant there, so it's almost always huge, except that when derivative is very small, you might expect some violation of this inequality. And in particular, if you believe in this conjecture, then ds vacuo is ruled out. Ds vacuo is the point where the first derivative is zero and the potential is positive. So this is what I mean by ds vacuo. It can be metastable, I don't care. And if this is the case, this is so those vacuo are ruled out by this inequality. Okay, this is a very trivial mathematics. So Cameron and others propose this conjecture. I would say that it's very speculative. Afterwards, it generated a lot of controversy, if you believe in this conjecture, it eliminates a lot of stuff like KKLT, large volume scenario, all these facts. plus Bacchio scenarios, and there are a lot of discussion ensued. But it seems that so far there seems to be no general, complete general consensus in the community. So while it's interesting to revisit all these issues, I took a rather different approach, which is that, it's fine to talk about the grand theory of the string theory and alpha prime correction string, et cetera. But before talking about that, we should first think about what we thought we know, which is, for example, the Higgs field in the standard model. And there is an extremely elemental observation that if you have the Higgs potential, and if you are at the top of this potential, there is no reason not to be here. So I'm not necessarily claiming that it happens in the history of the universe. It can be, but anyway, you can consider theoretically the possibility that the Higgs field is there, and then the first derivative is zero, and the potential energy is positive, so this inequality is obviously violated. So that's already, you can realize this after thinking about this 2 minutes, but it seems that this is already in tension with this conjecture. Well, except that there can be still loopholes, so if you want to think seriously, maybe there can be some other modification. For example, it might be that, there is a Higgs field, but there can be unknown Higgs-like field, as in supersymmetric theory or something like that. There can be other things. And suppose that it's a polynomial. Well, in this case, I chose a particular potential with the one more Higgs field, but it can be anything, and it can be many, many fields, many, many Higgs fields, etc. And then you might hope that it might solve the problem. It turns out this is, again, elementary mathematics. And at least under some assumptions, even if you take multiple Higgs fields and various different potentials, et cetera, there is always a point where this condition is satisfied. Under some assumption, there are some small loopholes, but these are very contrived possibilities. And another thing people thought about is, Higgs potential has a problem, but maybe suppose that exists some another field, quintessence. That's the thing which I'm coming to afterwards. But somehow it couples to the Higgs field by this combination, exponential. And this is, again, another very simple mathematics to show that, if you have such a coupling, there is a non-zero derivative with respect to this Q. So you can save the condition of the first derivative. There is always this Q. There is always a non-zero derivative in the direction of Q. So you can save this potential, for example. So these are some phenomenological loopholes. But interestingly, these possibilities are also extremely hard because of the results on the time dependence on the proton versus the electron. The way how it works is that, there is Higgs potential, there is a Higgs web, and that's a fixed number, except that if you try to take into account the quantum correction, there is a one-loop collections, and then the quintessence dependence does enter into the web of the Higgs. And so which means that this proton-electron mass ratio is time-independent, and that's already in tension with the experiment. If this coefficient C is all of one, that's what is. So this is a small example, but the point is that it's fine to have the interesting conjectures about the quantum gravity in general. Sometimes there are some interesting constraints coming from, in this case, the Higgs in particular, and that was helpful to make this conjecture very unplausible. And subsequently, people tried to revise the conjecture in various different ways. So people went to refine the DS conjecture, et cetera. And of course, then if you weaken it, it becomes harder to constrain this way. But they might sometimes have interesting constraints for inflation, et cetera. So that story continues. But that's one small example. It might not be the most exciting example, but it's one small example where phenomenological considerations does say something sharp about the conjectures where people in string theory committees don't necessarily have to come to a global agreement. So this is an idea how it works, but now I'm coming to my main topic. When I was first preparing the talk, I thought maybe I should try to skip through, all the various different things I've done. And this is the thing I just described, I did in my first paper. But then I realized there can be various interesting consequences, and I came to be interested in this topic, especially at the intersection of particle physics and cosmology and swamp-around business. And I have worked with various different people, many of whom are particle physicists or cosmologists. And for example, he's a postdoc at UCLA, and he has many papers in the astrophysics, for example. So for me, it's a fun to think about these ingredients. But of course, I don't have time to talk about everything. So rather than speaking too fast, and I try to be more relaxed. Maybe I'm still speaking too fast, or maybe too slow. I don't know. But rather than doing that, let me try to concentrate on this one particular paper in collaboration with Masahiro Ibe and Tsutomu Yanagida. And I liked a lot of short conference proceeding for that too, and the both are very short, so it's not too hard to read it if you're interested. But anyway, the main points I'm going to say today anyway. Okay, so so now I'm switching gears and I try to apply the Swampland ideas to the consideration of dark energy. And also, dark energy is certainly a very exciting topic and very mysterious. And I happen to notice that at Perimeter, there are a lot of dark energy related talks, even this week. And even right now, actually, I noticed that there is another talk about the dark energy and modified gravity. But anyway, so it's a very mysterious topic. And one of the things, surprising thing, first of all, is that there is a non-trivial value of the cosmological constant. And well, I came a little bit late to undergrad and graduate school, et cetera. So by the time I came to university, people knew that lambda is positive more or less. But if you look at the literature, a lot of very clever people wrote that lambda should be zero, for example. And they were wrong. And then the way it's settled is that by observations, with independent observations. And that I find extremely impressive. Although nowadays people take it for granted. And then, of course, there is a fact that the value of the lambda is extremely small. Well, extremely small, measured in units of the Planck scale. If measured in the Planck scale, the size of the dark energy, like a milli electron volt, so it's like, as far as the energy is concerned, it's like a 10 to minus 120. And of course, this is a notorious cosmological constant problem. And I should say that I'm not going to solve the cosmological constant problem in full generality today. So that's beyond me. And but still, this is an interesting quantity. And the one comment I have is that, okay, if this is a problem, the minimum comment I have is that, okay, first of all, this is extremely small energy, milli electron volt, especially in terms of the particle physics viewpoint. There is a neutrino mass and it's close to the scale, but any other elemental particles, they have much higher masses other than the like massless photons, et cetera, gravitons. And so that's extremely low energy in a sense. But once you formulate this question this way, it's also about UV. So that's extremely high energy Planck scale. So in a sense, this is an interesting interplay between UV and R. And if you try to think about this problem, in a sense, you have to think about UV too, because that's how I formulated the question. At least if you formulate this question that way. Well, some people say that, okay, I don't care about the Planck scale and I should have like 100 MeV here, et cetera. I heard of that opinion. But at least you formulate this question that way, this way, then you have to talk about UV physics at the Planck scale, which is the quantum gravity and string theory. So that's where there could be a room for Swampland ideas to come in. Okay, so but exactly how and the way it proceeds the forest. First of all, I take this dark energy, and I like to take the observational result series. The first of all, lambda is positive, but it generates a particular value of the dark energy. And then there is a conventional low energy effect field theory. And then I'm going to take an input from quantum gravity. And certainly there are a lot of papers discussing the dark energy from low energy effective field theory framework. And usually they don't care about the quantum gravity because whatever quantum gravity effects are that will generate one particular low energy effective field theory. But I ordered, okay, I explained already that, so that's what the effective field theorists might say. But that's actually misleading because not all the low energy field theories come from quantum gravity. So, so what I'm going to do is to try to take into account the constraints of quantum gravity in the formula of Swampland conjectures. So that's not everything about quantum gravity, but it's still useful input. Okay, so after this, let's try to come to how to realize the dark energy. Now, in quantum theories of quantum gravity like string theory, there is no such parameter, free parameter. So whatever the value of the dark energy is, that should arise somewhat dynamically. So what this means is that there is some scalar field, like a moduli, a string coupling constant, or some moduli, some scalar field, and it has a potential, certain potential, and there is a dynamic process where it equilibrates, so it comes to the local minimum, and that the value of the potential there gives light to the size of the dark energy. And this is the most dominant scenario. And but there can be other scenarios. For example, that's the scenario of the quintessence. So in the quintessence scenario, we are not actually at the local minimum, but it's actually still loading. So it's still loading. So the value of the dark energy is changing. But of course, if it changes too rapidly, and we will find it easily by observation, so we should find very slowly. So it should be very slow load. But nevertheless, that's another possibility. And a lot of people have the opinion that this is a more natural possibility, and there are good reasons for that. But nevertheless, I'm going to today think about this quintessence scenario. Okay, so why I'm going to do that? Well, partly because I was a little bit surprised as in thinking about the Swampland conjectures, etc., that there seems to be very few discussions of the quintessence scenario in quantum gravity and string theory context. There are certainly thousands of papers in quintessence, but not much taking into account constraints from UV. And also, people know that having the DS backyard, the other possibility, is somewhat difficult in weakly coupled regions of the parameter space. And superficially, it looks easier to get the quintessence. Although, in practice, it's not that easy. But and eventually, it's the nature to decide. So dark energy is the area where a lot of people saw that it should be zero and they were wrong, et cetera. So maybe we shouldn't be too biased and explore a possibility. Anyway, I want to consider this quintessence scenario. OK, so even if you consider this quintessence scenario, there are already some problems. For example, OK, so as I said already, if this slope of the potential is very large, and of course it loads too much, and that's a problem. So the potential should be extremely flat. And that's already a challenge because, you can light down some potential with a very flat, but there are all sorts of quantum corrections, and it's no longer flat. So the flatness is spoiled. That's the same issue as the similar issue as the inflation, but here, in a sense, the situation is worse because the relevant energy scale is much, much smaller. So there can be many potential sources for spoiling the flatness. So that's certainly one of the reasons why quintessence scenario is difficult. Okay, so but can we still try to proceed? So one possibility is to say that there is an underlying symmetry. So if you have low energy field series and want to explain something is small, and a good explanation usually is to consider some symmetry. And that's where this quintessence axiom comes in. So that's part of my title. Namely, so let's consider the scenario where there is some non-aberrant gauge field, FFT, so this is a topological term, and there's a set angle, dynamical set angle, which is promoted to a dynamical field. So this action divided by decay constant. So F is known as a decay constant, which has dimensional mass. Okay, so suppose something like this happens, and then A doesn't couple to anything else, and if this is the case, okay, and why it's good? That's because there is a shift symmetry perturbatively. The topological term doesn't do anything in the perturbation theory, so perturbatively there is a symmetry, but that's broken by non-perturbative symmetry and giving rise to this potential with the dynamical scale lambda. And of course, there's a dimensional transmutation, so there is a non-trivial scale, and lambda can be much, much smaller than Planck scale. If the value of this alpha is depending on the value of alpha, for example, can be very small. So this is how you get scale. So so you might expect that if there is any hope of explaining anything with the quintessence, this might be one of the most plausible scenarios because there is underlying symmetry reasons why there is such a small scale. Now, well, there can be multiple complaints, And certainly I'm not going to discuss all the complaints, but one of the complaints is that, okay, I said that there is some Noether and gauge field, and if you're a model builder, you're not, you're okay, you're used to that, but still, but it's like cooking up something which we don't know to explain one thing. It sounds bad, and also, okay, so there is a parameter alpha, and I need to fine tune this value of this alpha to explain dark energy. So it sounds too much to hope for. It's fine to do that, but it sounds unnatural. Is there a more minimal way of doing that? So that's the question. And it turns out that you don't actually need to introduce extra sector, because inside the standard model is an electro-weak SU2 gauge group. And that does exactly the right job. So what I mean is that, okay, so the value of alpha 2, the coupling constant, at the Z boson mass is like a 1 over 30, 1 over 29. And that doesn't reproduce the size of the dark energy. But if you do the RG learning all the way to the Planck scale, okay, let's assume here that there is no any part, no particle charged on the SU2. It sounds unnatural, but I'm coming to that towards the latter part of my talk. But let's first assume naively do the RG learning all the way to the Planck scale. And then you get the value like 1 over 48. And then it actually has the almost the correct value. So if you just plug in this value 1 over 48, and you get like a 10 to minus 130, which is very close to the value of the dark energy, which is like a 10 to minus 120. So this is very close. And in fact, if you like, this is just a classical piece, but if you like to make it closer, you can have a one loop piece. And that, then that will become even closer to minus 120. Anyway, so this is the numerology, but I think it's a curious one. And so that's the scenario of this electroweak quintessence action. So you do the quintessence action, but the action comes from the theta angle for electroweak SU2. Yeah, if you open the QFT textbook, they talk a lot about the QCD action, et cetera. And, but rarely about the electroweak action, partly because the associated energy scale is very small. And sometimes they even comment that, okay, the energy scale is so small, so it's irrelevant, et cetera. But I'm not saying that it's actually the same order of magnitude as the size of dark energy.
Is there any other parameters in alpha 2?
Let's see. So if you assume that there are no particle, et cetera, there is no parameter. Well, of course, you can change, for example, if you want to learn up to the reduced Planck scale or Planck scale, et cetera. But that's a logarithmic learning, so it doesn't change the order too much. Yeah. So it's actually, I didn't do anything fancy. I mean, I just learned it, and it's this value. So that's an interesting observation, I think, going back to the 90s or so. Well, there is a subtle question, but first of all, theoretical questions. And then if you look at in the literature, there are sometimes some confusions about this. So one of the questions is that, okay, I know that, isn't that the case that electroweak theta angle is unphysical? And what I mean by that is that electroweak SU2 is the chirality is, okay, so maximally violated, maximally chiral. So so this can be loaded in a way by anomalies of B plus L global symmetry. So there's an anomaly, so isn't that you can rotate away the theta angle, so isn't that unphysical? And that's true, that's not true once you include the higher dimension operators. So in the standard model, you can write on dimension 6 operator QQQL, and that breaks the B plus L symmetry, and then hence makes the theta angle dynamical. Not dynamical, physical, non-trivial. And the fact that there exists such operator is very natural from low energy effective field theory viewpoint. And somewhat related with that, there is an interesting feature in when you do the computations of the instanton action. So in the usual QCD, when you do the instanton computations, okay, so there is this is a standard factor, and this low is the size module of the instanton. So the instanton module, in the one instanton computation, the size of the vacuum energy goes like this. So, and the size modulus integrates from zero to infinity. Now, if you take the more familiar theory like a QCD, what happens is that, okay, so the coupling constant depends on this scale low, so you can do the one loop beta function to extract that factor, and then it turns out it has a positive factor low in total. So that's the reason why there's a dominant contribution comes from low infinity, so named very deep IR. And that's the famous IR problem of the QCD. And I have some papers discussing the connection of that to confinement and the resurgence, et cetera. But anyway, so that's the typical divergence comes from the UV. IR. That's very different in the electroweak SU2. Well, first of all, the Marlowe beta function coefficient changes 7 to 19/6. But it's also the case that you need a higher dimension operator. So this is related with what I said before. So without a higher dimension operator, there is a B plus L symmetry, so the theta angle is not physical, so there is no potential. In other words, when you do the one instanton computation, you have to kill the zero modes. And in order to kill the zero modes, you have to use this higher dimension operator. And it's a dimension 6, so it's suppressed by 1 over Planck scale, squared. And there are 3 generations, so you have to take 3 of them, giving rise to this factor. So precisely because of this factor, even the power of the law changes, and you get the negative power in the instanton computation in electroweak SU2. So this divergence near the zero, and the usual argument is that, okay, it diverges, but there is some unknown physics at the Planck scale which make it finite. So that's where this Planck scale comes in. In this analysis, I declared before that I just should evaluate this at the Planck scale, but that arises from some subtleties of the instanton calculus I explained. Anyway, so this is the numerology, and so you can try to push that further and then say, okay, so dark energy, you don't have to include any extra ingredient, you're just the electroweak SU2, and it generates the correct size of dark energy, and you might be happy. That's what that's the electroweak quintessence action scenario. And if you're low energy effective fuel cells, that's as far as you cannot go too farther. But there is an extra constraint, which is the weak gravity conjecture, which is one of the Swan-Prandt conjectures. So what is the weak gravity conjecture? So weak gravity conjecture comes in various different versions and et cetera, and it's complicated history and et cetera. But in this talk, I'm very pedagogical, very practical. And in practice, I just need this inequality. Okay, so what does it mean? So F is a decay constant, the parameter. But it just basically means that F is bounded by the Planck scale. It should be much smaller than Planck scale. A little bit more precise statement, F is bounded by the Planck scale divided by the size of the instant action. So if you prime in the value of the alpha 2, it's like 100. So F is parametrically smaller than the Planck scale by 2 orders of magnitude. This is what is implied by the weak gravity conjecture. And that's promoted the general principle, but you can also try to look at various concrete string theory realizations, and people know that it's hard to make the decay constant extremely large. And why is this a problem? It's in tension with what should be the case. Namely, so this is the mass of that axion. And the mass of the action is given by this formula. Mass is determined as second derivative. So each time you take a derivative, there is a 1 over factor 1 over f. And there was already this dynamical scale. So this mass is given by this combination. And if you use the standard cosmological formulas, this is the size of this dark energy related with the current value of the Hubble. And this means that if the, the observational constraint is the follows. So this should be smaller than the current value of the Hubble. And this is because the Hubble in the cosmological expansion, Hubble plays the role of the friction term. So as long as the mass is comparable or larger than the Planck, as long as the Hubble is larger than the Planck scale, then there is a friction term, it doesn't move. So it stays at the potential forever. But the Hubble is smaller, for example, 0, for example, there is no asterisk expansion, then of course it begins to roll. And you won't want the rolling to happen too dramatically. And that's why you need this condition, and that gives that the condition that decay constant is larger than the Planck scale. Anyway, that's what the phenomenological constraint, observational constraint, and that seems to be battery in tension with this weak gravity conjecture. So that's a fatal blow to this quintessence scenario. Oh, okay. So if you're a model builder, you try to look for various loopholes. And one of the loopholes people find is that, okay, maybe I should try to fine tune the initial condition to this top of this grid distance potential. Basically, the idea is that if you're very close to the top of the potential, then you might have loaded, started loading, but haven't loaded too much. And it's fine. And that's the hilltop quintessence scenario. Except that it's actually very bad, because if you try to see what kind of how much fine tuning is needed at this top of the boundary conditions, then it turns out that the order of the initial condition fine tuning is order of exponential Planck divided by the decaying constant. And there was an order 100 separation between these two scales. So you have order of exponential 100 fine tuning you need, which looks extremely bad. So this option seems to be eliminated. Well, if you don't want to fine tune this amount. Now, but I still don't give up, and all people still didn't give up. So for example, this is the same slide as before. But if you try to compare with these things, the problem happens because of the size of this instant action. So then maybe, let's say, one day you might have come up with a great idea. OK, this is the problem. Why don't you change the size of this instant action, alpha 2? For example, alpha 2 is 2 pi. There is no such factor. And then you can satisfy both these constraints at f equals n prime. Well, can you do that? Well, OK, so for that, you need the value of alpha 2 to be changed at the Planck scale. And previously, I get this value 1 over 48, such that the instant action is 100. But if you want to change it, OK, sure, I can change the RG running by including heavy particles to instant action order 10, order 1, et cetera. And then you have fine tuning is much better. So one day, you might come up with this possibility. It's contrived, but nevertheless, you might think about that. It happens that it's actually very bad, because once you try to change the value of the instant action, and then you change the whole starting point, because you have this lambda, and I motivated the whole scenario by saying that, OK, it gives light to 1 over 48, and it generated the correct value of the dark energy. But I'm now saying that, OK, you try to satisfy the weak gravity conjecture, but I spoiled the whole story. So for this reason, it seems that we are in a complete dead end. And that's where, let's see, so we come to talk about the supersymmetric extension of the model. And there are some interesting things happening, and that's going to be very crucial for saving the scenario. OK, so let's first consider, let's start from scratch, and let's consider electroweak axion, but together with this MSSM, minimal extension of the supersymmetric standard model. And I choose the Suzy breaking scale to be like a 10 to 10 GeV, and the spatial masses to be like a TeV, for example. It can be 10 TeV, etc. There are some parameter regions. But let's say TeV for naturalness. And then let's consider the electroweak set angle again. And redo the whole analysis. And then you have to change many of the stories. Well, first of all, well, it's a well-known story, minimal extension, supersymmetric extension of the supersymmetric standard model, that if you have a supersymmetric standard model, then there is dangerous dimension 5 proton, dimension 5 operators, which is in tension with the constraints on proton decay. Well, there is even a dimension 4 operator, which is dangerous for Fourier changing neutral current. But let's say you pose a Z2 symmetry to forbid it. And then there is a dimension 5 operator. So if this coefficient of this is 1 over Planck, that's already in tension with experiment. That's a well-known story. And what people done is to, OK, maybe there is some undirected reason why the coefficient in front of here is small. And that goes by the name of the Frogat-Newsom symmetry. So there is some symmetry which is broken and by the Babelson field, which is smaller parametrically than the Planck scale. And then that generates some powers of this parameter, which I denoted Ipsilon. And OK, so it looks like a contrived scenario, and it is in a sense. But it also has a virtue that if you have this such a small parameter, it helps to explain the quark and the lepton mixing matrix, like for example, neutrino mixing met PMSS or CKM matrices, those people have measured and then tried, there is some interesting hierarchy. The coefficients are not all the coefficients, all the one. So people tried to explain that hierarchy, and that can be explained by this Rogoff-Diessen symmetry. So you're imposing this extra symmetry, but you're explaining something else. Okay, but and this parameter epsilon is going to be important. And this parameter particle value, like a 17, is chosen in such a way that it fits nicely with the structure of the CKM matrix. Okay, so this is so far, and let's come back to electroweak axioms. Now, in a sense, we might seem to have a huge problem already here, because we have more matter, so that RG learning changes. So originally it was 1 over 48, but now we have extra matter, so it becomes 1 over 23. So it actually seems to be very bad already. However, if you do the instanton computation, things are a little bit different, partly because there are some extra powers. Well, first of all, there is this Frogat-Neusen symmetry and the small breaking parameter, and there are some power of that coming to that. And also, instead of having the fourth power of the Planck scale, there is a cubic power of the Suzy breaking scale, which I took to be TV. So there are some interesting factors here coming here and there. So although the value of alpha 2 is different, there are some extra suppression factor. And that it turns out if you combine all the factors, for example, the value of epsilon was chosen to explain the quark mixing matrix, not to explain this, but somehow if you plug in these values, you get the correct order of magnitude for the size for the dark energy. So after all, supersymmetric theory, you need to change the story in multiple ways. And many of the things I said before, for example, this certainly is a standard in MSSM discussion, but if you include that, and first of all, you get the correct size of the dark energy. Okay, now I'm coming back to the issue of the, of course, that is what we already did when we discussed non-supersymmetric case. But we now have to satisfy the weak gravity conjecture. And what's going to happen? So the idea is still the same. So you can try to include the heavy matter to change the value of RG running of the alpha 2 so that the weak gravity constraint is, so you try to make the value for alpha larger and larger so that there is less fine tuning. And that you can do by including some heavy particles charged on the SU2. With a mass mx. And if it's some representation r, there is some Dynkin index coming to the one loop running of this alpha. And in the non-supersymmetric case, the problem was that, okay, it's fine to change the RG running, but it changes the scale of the dynamical scale of the instanton. However, the non-trivial point, in fact, this is almost the only non-trivial point, is that once you include heavy particles, we are in the supersymmetric theory. So it inevitably introduces the fermions. So there are extra zero modes in the instanton calculus. So you have to insert extra operators proportional to the mass of this operator. So you're going to get the suppression factor of mx, this mass of this heavy field divided by Planck scale to some power. And if you do this computation, you get this the same coefficient as before. So let me repeat, if you include the heavy particles, that changes the RG learning, and it is easier to satisfy the weak gravity conjecture constraint. For us, so that changes the value of alpha, but somehow there is extra factor coming out. So what happened to the energy scales once you include this x and x bar? So this is the original expression, but I said already that you need to kill extra zero mode, so there is extra suppression factor. And in addition, this RG learning is also different because you now have extra heavy field. And it turns out that these two effects precisely cancel out. There should be some conceptual explanation for this, but it's certainly the case. And then that means that this size of this dark energy is actually the same, preserved, even if you add the heavy field to the story. And this is actually nice. Well, first of all, you can change the RG learning, And it's easier to satisfy the weak gravity conjecture constraint. But it's also the case that the size of the dark energy, which is the whole starting point of our discussion, is robust under the inclusion of such supersymmetric multiples. So even if you have a supersymmetric multiple charged on the SC2 along the way, you might expect all RG learning changes, so this value of lambda might change, but it's not. So the value of lambda is just as the same as before, without any heavy matters. So we are not just having one problem of trying to satisfy the weak gravity conjecture, but it turns out that the value of this lambda is now much more robust against the inclusion of heavy particles. And of course, it might be, well, you never know what's up there in higher energy scales, but it might be natural to imagine that there are some heavy fields charged on the SU2. And this point says that that doesn't spoil our story. So this is how it works. Maybe I can skip this, and so I can actually skip a lot of stuff. So this is how it works. I can already try to summarize. So I explained the electroweak quintessence axion scenario, and as the name says, it says that there is electroweak SC2 axion. That's electroweak axion, and electroweak axion can play the role of the quintessence axion. Hence explains the dark energy is loading. And the whole point is based on the observation that the size of the dark energy is roughly given by this one instanton expression and determined by alpha 2. And first of all, I explained the non-supersymmetric case that is already extremely close to the observed value. But I explained why there is some constraint from the weak gravity conjecture. And so for that reason, that this weak gravity conjecture, if we believe it, that disfavors this scenario. However, if you consider the supersymmetric extension of the model, there are learning changes, but somehow you have a different suppression factors, and still you get the correct size of dark energy. So I think this is an interesting scenario, especially if you take that very seriously, the particular value of dark energy, like 10^-120.
Sam, I'm a bit confused.
Yes?
10^-130 and then 10^-120?
Yes.
The difference between the top and bottom is you have M Planck to the, is that M Planck a square there you have?
Oh, sorry, this is the force power. Sorry, so first of all. Yeah, okay. That's right. First of all, this should be the force power. So what is the difference? Right, so one difference is, of course, the alpha is different. Yeah, that's right. Sorry, I probably should have written explicitly. But this alpha 2 is a learning for non-supersymmetric theory. But here, you consider the supersymmetric extension of everything. So there are extra matter and charge on the SC2, so that changes the origin learning.
So I guess I missed the beginning of the talk.
Oh, no problem, yes.
So how do we know what alpha 2 is?
Yeah, so for example, here in this scenario, I assumed that there are no. Well, okay, let's take the standard mode of particles that we know. And let's assume that there are no particles in the intermediate region between Planck scale and the Z boson mass, which is charged on the SC2. That's an extremely strong assumption, but if we assume that and do that running all the way to the Planck scale, and then probably in the value, it's somehow getting a very close value. Now, in this supersymmetric version, I do this, well, let's see. First of all, alpha 2 itself you can compute. Let's start by assuming that, again, similar thing. So MSSM, no particles charged, no supersymmetric multiples charged on the SC2, and do the RG learning. And then there is a robot Nielsen symmetry suppression factor, there is R symmetry, et cetera, and then there is some extra factor coming in. Yeah, that's right. And then somehow this extra suppression factor cancels the difference in the RG learning.
So I guess one question is that, so this is just one contribution to vacuum energy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what about other
countries? Yeah, now I don't have anything intelligent to say. In other words, I wanted to say that I'm not necessarily solving the cosmological constant problem. And this can be easily, very easily overshadowed by anything, in fact, almost anything contribution. So of course, in order for this scenario, to make this scenario into a real possibility, you have to need some mechanism to control everything else to any other contribution to dark energy. To vacuum energy, and say that maybe sum up to zero or something like that. And I don't necessarily have anything intelligent to say, but my approach today is that, okay, so let's see. So let's try to take the input from observation seriously, this particular value, like my 120. Not just, well, people often formulate, okay, this is a small number you have to explain, et cetera, but not just a small one, not to 10 to 1 minus 50 or not, like 80 or so, but it's just this particular number. And since we know, there are very few things we know about the dark energy, so maybe the fact that this particular number might be telling you something. And of course, the anthropic consideration is one direction to that direction, but could there be other explanation of this number? And I think there are very few scenarios where this particular number is explained in something more fundamental. And the something fundamental in this case is just a standard model. Yes?
Little m,
Susie, what
is that again?
Yeah, it's a 1 TeV, for example. So that's the mass of the supersymmetric particles. Yeah, that's right. So of course it's a parameter, so you can try to change it, for example. And well, here I have in mind motivating that through naturalness, for example. And but of course as a scenario, so in a sense there is an external parameter here which helps, but in a sense it's not as rigid as before, in a sense. So you can try to, okay, maybe some people don't care about naturalness these days, and let's take a PEB, for example, like a 10 to 3 TeV, for example. Some people discuss PEB supersymmetry, for example. And then this is larger, and then actually you don't need that much of a Fregat-Nielsen suppression. So you actually don't need this suppression. And then this thing becomes a large margin, much larger number. And interesting, if you can, then the size of this becomes the mass of this thing becomes much larger. And cross becomes like a minus 10 to 22 or so. So which is close to the mass of the dark energy, dark matter, which we know as a quasi dark matter, for example. So okay, if you like, you can try to play around with this possibility. But I'm not really pushing that because it's just one playing around with the parameter. So, but at least the point we hear is that if you take some for naturalness reasons or other reasons, if you take to be TeV, it seems to be the right order magnitude. But of course, there can be, I didn't include a factor of pi, et cetera, or there are also powers of alpha coming from one loop, et cetera. So if you want to be precise, then you can try to do the game of playing around with parameters, et cetera. And so there is definitely room, but at least, originally we were talking about this is Planck, et cetera, so we try to have a light order magnitude, like, and that's the that's how I view it here. And the nice, so but nice thing about the supersymmetric case is that here I had to assume that there is no particles charged on the SC2, but you don't necessarily need this assumption for this lambda. So there are some virtues here, and in addition to satisfying weak gravity conjecture. Yeah, and so this is the, and then basically I said what is written here, but it's a very simple scenario to explain this particular size of dark energy. And I took into account, I spent 10 minutes also explaining Swampland conjecture, but in this talk particular, I just used only the weak gravity conjecture. Well, I have a couple slides about other conjectures, et cetera, but so far minimally I only need this conjecture, but that was already powerful. And okay, so this I said already, and then once you have.
Can you elaborate on that Hilbert region or fine tuning?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, that's right. So I was talking about that before you came, but okay. So let's talk about the non-supersymmetric case, right? Just the usual Hilbert. Usual quintessence action, and just declare that it's electro weak, for example. And then what is the problem? Well, the problem is that there is a the mass tends to be. Let's see, maybe it's faster to go to this slide. So, so we want this condition that mass is not too large.
Okay.
Yeah, and that says that the decay constant is Planck or larger. But the weak gravity conjecture says that decay constant should be smaller, for example.
Okay.
And but of course this assumes that the generic point in the cosine. So you might think, okay, if you fine tune to the very, very top of the potential of the quintessence potential, then of course this is not true. I mean, it's loading but hasn't started loading yet, so.
You eventually fall down. So
that's right. So you have to fine tune extremely, basically because once you start loading, it accelerates. So, it's fine to fine tune the initial conditions, and that's what people propose. But it turns out fine tuning is extremely bad, like exponential of 100 or something like that. Yeah. So that's the problem with hilltop quintessence. Of course, you can maybe somehow say that, okay, I don't know, but you can try to argue for that. But it doesn't sound too appealing. I mean, at some point, people may hope that maybe, okay, there is a 1% fine-tuning to fine-tune the top of the hill, and it's okay. And then maybe you can live with that. But it's insane fine-tuning you have to do. And so that was the problem. And that problem arises because the hierarchy between this decay constant and the Planck scale, which in turn comes from the weak gravity conjecture. Yeah, so that was how I tried to motivate the extension to supersymmetry, where it's easier to satisfy that constraint. Yeah, so so I talked about the scenario, and it's probably interesting to think about implications. And yeah, I don't know, but for example, Satori, well, it's a quintessence scenario, so it's loading, so the value of the dark energy changes. So, and the usual state equation state parameter W, for example, W changes. And there's a parameter space to play around, and I'm not good at doing the Bayesian analysis and things like that. So I just did one particular, I forgot this parameter, maybe decay constant Planck, and then you start with the middle of the potential or something like that, and then you have this thing. So this is the scale factor, so it's right now, and this is before. So early times it's very close to W equals minus one, like a cosmological constant. But then, well, it's natural because it's at some pop the potential, and there is a Hoppe friction, so it stays there. It effectively behaves like a constant, but then it begins to deviate. And well, in this particular case, it doesn't deviate too much even now. So probably it's very difficult to detect this case. But I haven't exhausted all the parameter searches, et cetera. And even without this electroweak quintessence, people did do this parameter search already. It depends on, especially on the initial conditions. And anyway, so there maybe in some lucky cases, we might be able to exclude this possibility already in some future measurement of W, like coming from the observation, like Euclid, W first, ABSST, et cetera. And also, well, once you have these axions like things, and then there can be like a Faraday rotation, it couples to E times V in a sense. Well, this couples to electroweak cases too, but you might imagine that after electroweak breaking, it couples to a photon, and I haven't thought too much about it, but then there might be a rotation. And people certainly talked about this in the context of QCD axion, et cetera. So, but it's just the same thing, but its energy scale is different, and maybe there can be some constraints from the birefringence. And finally, here I talked about the electroweak axion. Surprisingly, there are very few literature on that, compared with the QCD axion, where there are literally thousands of papers on that. And at least morally speaking, if you have the QCD axion, why not the axion for the electroweak SA2? Regardless of whether it's a dark matter or not, sorry, dark energy or not. So it's interesting to think more seriously about the electroweak axion in general. So that's basically it. And so today I discussed about particular scenario, electroweak quintessence axion, based on the value of the dark energy, and mostly from low energy fixed field theory argument from the axions, the weak gravity conjecture in the form of the Swan-Plant conjectures. So I talked about this. Whether you buy this particular scenario itself is a matter of question, but I talked about this scenario as just a case study where there are some interesting constraints coming from Swan-Plant conjectures, and that eliminates some possibilities and which motivates further model building, so that in order to satisfy all the constraints. And for me, of course there are little observational constraints, and most of the low energy physics friends I know don't care about the Swan-Plant conjectures. But in a sense, it's natural to take into account if all the ingredients available, including the Swan-Plant conjectures. That's what I'm doing now. So this is an example where interesting constraints from the Swan-Plant conjectures. But as I said before, there are some cases where these observational constraints does say something about the precise version of the Swan-Plant conjecture as well. So I think it's an interesting area where there is an interaction between string theories and cosmologies and particle physicists. Thank you.
Thank
Sanderson-Masahiro. Okay.